Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth with you. John Vecchione is not with us this week, but in his place, I have one of my litigation counsel colleagues here at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, Casey Norman. Casey, excited to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I'll try to impersonate John the best I can.
Well, you have to talk with your hands and try, you know, don't hit the microphone too often. it's the reason that we've invited Casey on is that she has been burning the midnight oil, as I was just saying to her, working really hard on one of our Title IX cases here. That actually one of our very first cases we ever brought at NCLA. It's either the first or second client we ever signed up. Dr. Makun Vengelator was a physics professor at Cornell University who came up for tenure. And when he came up for tenure, a former graduate student who had been dismissed from the program for academic reasons, I think, if I remember correctly, but feel free to correct me on that, Casey, started hurling allegations against him. And it started with relatively minor things, like he threw a power supply at her, which there wasn't evidence that that had happened either. But then ultimately accusing him of sexual misconduct. And she had said before leaving campus that she was going to do that her plan was to do whatever it took to deny him tenure. And unfortunately, Cornell's Title IX processes just didn't give Dr. Vengelator the kind of due process in the investigation and the adjudication of these accusations that the Title IX, frankly, entitles him to get. And so we have sued Cornell University. The case has already been up to the Second Circuit once because the Northern District of New York said, well, you know, this only covers students, it doesn't cover faculty, so we had to go up and win that case at the Second Circuit. Now we're back down, and Casey has been working on our opposition to the university's motion for summary judgment. And so tell our audience, Casey, what are the issues in the case? And you could probably spend an hour on this, but what are maybe the two or three biggest issues in the case that are the points of contention with the government right now at the motion for summary judgment stage?
Right. So, yeah, as you said, I could probably speak for days about this case. There's a lot of evidence at this stage in the litigation, but Cornell's main arguments right now are basically that it followed its own procedures, which I can't even say with a straight face. it's very difficult, but they try to say that, you know, they didn't violate his rights.
We always pick and choose among five different procedures as to what we're going to do in
exactly.
a case.
Yeah. so they argue that. They try to argue, we also have a defamation claim in our complaint, so they try to argue that it was Mukund who spread word about these, you know, sexual misconduct findings of this Dean Ritter at Cornell, and they try to pin it on him instead of Cornell. So those are kind of our two claims. One, the Title IX claim, and the focus of that is really just arguing that Cornell violated a litany of its own procedures in a very irregular, biased manner, and we argue that that was because prior to this investigation, the Department of Education had released or issued this guidance kind of imposing stricter rules on universities for sexual misconduct complaints. And this was targeted, you know, mainly at men because men are overwhelmingly those accused of those kinds of things.
Right. And so we're essentially asking the court to infer from Cornell's violations of its own policies and its failure to extend due process to Dr. Vengelator, that they were doing so for discriminatory reasons?
Right, exactly. And we have, you know, the lead Title IX investigator at Cornell. As he was conducting this investigation, he was also in the process of kind of responding to the Department of Education, trying to make rules and procedures stricter against faculty members. So at the exact same time that he's kind of breaking the rules and trying to apply, you know, new procedures that he was in the process of trying to revise that didn't actually get accepted by Cornell, you know, he's imposing them on Dr. Vengelator and violating the rules that were actually in place and applicable to a complaint like this.
Well, that seems terrible. And you know, when we talk about due process, it's not, I mean, the reason due process matters isn't just because everyone deserves due process, whether you're innocent or you're guilty or what, it's not just that. It's that the due process mechanisms are calculated to figure out whether the accusations are true or not, right? I mean, if Cornell had done what it was supposed to do and had done the kind of investigation that I think it would have done had Dr. Vengelator not been a man and frankly perhaps had not been of Indian descent, then I think you would see that that they would have taken seriously his defenses to the accusations more than they did.
Right. And at some point they argue that they're a private university, so they don't have to really adhere to due process like public universities do. But I mean, the bottom line remains they have to follow their own procedures. I mean, there has to be some semblance of due process, and they try to skirt that by saying, you know, we do what we want because we're private and we can improvise our rules, which just isn't the case. It simply is not the case. And that is what they did at this time. And if you read their rules...
That almost sounds like an admission of guilt that they improvised their processes.
Yeah. I mean, if you read the actual procedures that should have applied, Dr. Vinglator should have, you know, gotten the rights to a hearing and to confront the witnesses, to cross-examine. He didn't get any
to know the accusation.
Right.
For the longest time, he was not informed of the accusation against him.
For months. And this was because his tenure review had just begun. And, you know, we argue that there is evidence that the Dean Ritter, who made the ultimate determination to deny him tenure, knew at this time about the sexual misconduct and sexual assault allegations, and she didn't inform him. Because, of course, you know, there's a conflict of interest if the dean who's making the decision has been informed of these uninvestigated allegations. And she didn't inform him for 5 months.
Didn't inform him and now claims that she didn't know about the accusations at the time she was making the tenure decision, but the evidence really doesn't seem to support her on that. So that's one of the things that we think, that's one of the reasons we think there shouldn't be summary judgment here. We think that's a factual question for a jury, right?
Right. Yeah. The whole point of this is if there's any factual dispute or a dispute of a material fact, then it should go to trial for a jury to decide. It's not cut and dry. And Cornell tries to say that it's so obvious that they followed their procedures. There's really no argument there. But based on the hundreds of pages of evidence that we've reviewed and included in our filing last night, I would tend to disagree.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, it was. I have not looked at the entire record, but I did, you know, read the filing itself, and it's an impressive piece of legal work. So congratulations to you on that, Casey.
Thank you.
And your colleagues, Caitlin Schiraldi, I know, has been working on that, and Jeanette Brown has been working on it
right.
as well. So quite a good team of attorneys here have been putting their shoulder to the wheel, but Casey has been leading the effort. And tell me where this is. So what happens now? So they had filed their motion for summary judgment. You've now filed your opposition. Do they get a rebuttal to that, or does this go straight to the judge?
They will have a reply. I believe in a month they'll be filing that, and then we'll see what happens with the judge. And then I think our next step is trial.
Okay. So if he accepts the motion for summary judgment, then you could appeal that to the Second Circuit for the second time, I guess.
Right.
If he denies it, then trial would likely be the next, or there'll be some additional discovery, or the discovery's closed now.
I would hope the discovery is closed. We conducted extensive discovery in this case, and I think we're at this point where it's closed, and I think the next step would be trial.
Okay. Terrific. Well, that would be that would finally maybe get us towards some. Opportunity for vindication for Dr. Vinglator. I think he's been really dragged through the mud by this whole process. And I don't think you were with us at the time yet, Casey. But when we first took on this case, the reason it came to NCLA is we heard that Cornell was so there was a student, not the student who accused him, a different student in his physics lab. Who came to Dr. Vinglator's defense when these accusations first aired and became public and said, there's no way that this is true. Like, I've been in the lab with Dr. Vinglator every day. There's no way these accusations are correct. And wrote this in the student newspaper. And Cornell was going to pull his diploma and not let him walk across the stage because he had written an op-ed in the student paper in support of his professor. And we heard about that and we said, whoa, and you know, yeah, you need some legal representation. That's not acceptable. And so we spoke to the student and he said he already had legal representation, but he said that, you know, Dr. Vinglator, you know, didn't yet on aspects of this case. And, you know, because of the nature of the sexual misconduct accusations, you know, we were a little bit leery of you know, jumping into the case, particularly as one of our first cases as an organization. But I tell you, the more that I've read and the more that I've seen about this case, I just the charges just don't hold water. I mean, it's a really thin set of facts here that the university is trying to use to destroy someone's career.
Right. I mean, that's ultimately what they did. He was unhirable. He reached out to other universities and they told him, we want to hire you, but with these sexual misconduct allegations on the table, they need to be resolved. We can't hire you. And that's the one career he wants to pursue.
The other thing that's kind of devastating about this is the sort of the top peak performance years of any physics professor or sort of mental giant, which is what I consider Dr. Vengelator, it's in those 20s to 30s is really the prime of your career. They've already robbed him of that. Doesn't mean that if we win this case, he can't get back into the academy, because hopefully he will be able to do that. But they've already taken from him something, not to mention the opportunity for many students to learn under him, because right. he has a lot to offer and to teach. What do you expect the department university to push back on the hardest?
I mean, they've very much adamantly claimed that Dean Ritter didn't know about these allegations at the time that she made the tenure decision. They claim that they could basically improvise the procedures, the policies that they could apply to the investigation. I think they're just going to keep hounding on that, because I don't see how else. They can't really head on address our arguments, because it's clearly in their policies what they should have done. So
right.
I think they're trying.
And they don't they don't deny that they didn't do those
right.
things. Yeah.
Right. And the defamation claim, they're going to try to pin it on Dr. Vengelator. And it is tricky when you're talking about many, many people knowing about allegations like this, to pin it on one person. But
absolutely. Well, thanks again for your hard work on this. The case is Vengelator v. Cornell University, pending in the Northern District of New York District Court. And we'll invite you back to find out more about the case as developments occur. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you.